listeners. I'm Logan McLean, and this is OJT, On the Job Training. It's a podcast where I, a journalism student, practice my craft by interviewing passionate people about their projects. This episode features part two of my interview with fellow journalism student Alex McIsaac. We talk about defunding the police, the role of journalists in public discourse, and stepping away from it all by working with your hands. On a slightly different note, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, in the last several weeks in the United States, there's been, some people have called it an uprising. I'm sure people in different political opinions call it some different things.
Yeah.
But with that, there's been really interesting and highly publicized pattern of journalists being attacked by police and pretty blatantly just doing journalism. What are your thoughts on that? How do you feel as a potential journalist? I know Charlottetown PEI is a little different, but
yeah, no, I think that's, I'm not, I mean, day to day, no, I'm not, because I feel like I'm in a cushy little bubble, I think in the States, what you're saying is it's a top down sort of system where, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but like you have probably a conservative leaning police force, listening to a president who's saying XYZ, which I think is a little violent, some may say. So they're doing violence. I think it's like pretty simple. It's not, obviously, but you know what I mean? I think it's like there's a flow chart for it. I think you could definitely say, like, I don't want to say people, like, I think maybe cops just want to like fight people. I don't know. Like, I think there are different, let's say, ideologies, and maybe the police have a different one, you know, maybe it's a little bit more, you know,
the kind of a way I've heard a lot of the situation described with sort of the combativeness is that with the way that police have been militarized in the last however many years, there's a mindset not so much of we are members of this community, we are protecting our community, so much as we are combatants in a war zone.
Yeah.
And criminals are the bad guys, we are the good guys. And you know what I mean? Like that. What do you think about that sort of mindset?
Well, I think
do you think that's a thing?
Yeah. I mean, why does the Charlottetown Police Department have like a SWAT, like up armored, like Bearcat looking thing that you could see? I mean, you see, I don't know, like a DEA raid with, but I just don't. So what I see is I just don't see why the Charlottetown Police Department needs like a up armored SUV that is like a personnel carrier to a large degree. I feel like that's a lot of money. I feel like it probably costs like at least $100 to just drive it down the street, which like they're not paying for. So like, why, guys? I've seen it in action, breaking up parties of high schoolers.
Really?
Yeah, they like drive. Yeah, yeah, for sure. When I was in high school, so I think that says it all, man. I don't, and it's also like a training thing. Like you have the counterpart to the person, their counterparts who use those types of vehicles and weapons. I was driving. I told you about my encounter the other day. With the dude down my street who like had like a gun or whatever, like a replica gun and the whole, anyway, I got driven to the police station to like, we chatted about it and the dude had an AR-15 like next to him in the seat of the squad car. Like you look at who has AR-15s? Well, the police and the army. Who has these like up armored SUVs? Police and the army. At least the army are consistently training. Are the police training at like a level at which they're actually proficiently taught how to use this sort of equipment? Or, you know, is there just like a funding? I'm not saying it's cause necessarily, because I've also heard good arguments for, well, if you actually defund, you're going to. Oh, yeah, sorry. If you actually defund, you could end up with a lack of training also, because they don't want to get, you know, they're not going to want to get rid of their shiny toys. Like why? Right. So if they're not going to get rid of shiny toys, they're going to get rid of training. They're going to get rid of various other sort of things that I think they could use as an asset. So, yeah, I just don't. Whereas I feel like a diversification of funds could be beneficial. Necessarily just taking money away from police forces, I feel like they won't deal with that well. And what will come from that is like an augmented division between an us and them sort of thing. You know, I think that there needs to be like more funding for, say, mental health crisis workers who are going in and they're unarmed and they actually know how to like deal with situations. But I don't know if necessarily a straight up, let's just defund would be sustainable.
Yeah. Like that's where some of the argument for truly radical change comes from. Mm-hmm. Because if you, like you're saying, if you just take away some of the funding, but mm-hmm. you don't control the allocation, mm-hmm. then you can cause other problems. But if you completely tear down one system and try and reestablish a different institution.
Yeah.
But well, that's such a,
look at like, it's almost a project. Yeah, like look at like when a, and this is completely different and completely on a different set of a different scale. But when you see a foreign power invading a country and trying to work with the government, it doesn't really go well, and because they've splintered this government into various factions, or even I mean, you see the United States invasion of Iraq. Or what happened even before that? What happens with the Baathists, you know? And they just splinter off and fraction, and it's a completely different. And it's absolute apples and oranges, but it's maybe a little bit representative of what people do when you start coming for their cool shit, you know. I was listening to a podcast, and they actually had some like Iraqi vets or Iraq vets on their American soldiers. And they were talking about how there was a faction of armed insurgents in Iraq in the early days and later days of the war that were actually just old generals. And they just wanted their power back, right? You know, if we defund the police and splinter it up, who are going to be the old generals? They're not going away. Like, these guys will still be in society in some way. Like,
that's a very good point, because that is what happens after, like, civil wars.
Yeah.
And or, like, you get rid of a terrorist organization. Well, yeah. What are those people going to do when they don't have jobs with guns anymore? They're, you know what I mean? If they're people who've only ever been trained to do one thing, too, when all they know is violence, it's awfully hard to learn other skills. So it's like the KKK was originally made up of Confederate soldiers after they lost the war and wanted to continue terrorizing, you know, the former slaves. Yeah, there's always unintended consequences when one thing is.
Yeah, I also think that there are other things that we could like probably, if we really did an audit of our government and we're like, oh, where could we? Because I don't think it would be a lot. It would be. I don't want to speculate as to how much it would cost to install a similar kind of like a crisis response unit that was unarmed and trained in situations where the police weren't maybe not necessary, like mental health issues or domestic issues, whatever it may be. I think that there's some other things we could probably cut too. I think that we could probably let the police have their shiny stuff, keep them away. You know, keep them, let them do their thing, let them wear Oakleys and like rip around and like be weird and do their fuck, live their life, do the thing, but just keep them away. And then like have this other group who are like, yeah, don't listen. My uncle, he's kind of fucking crazy. Just let him do his thing. And then I'll deal with it. And then we just keep them and they're like, I don't know, let them live their life and just. But keep them away.
But will they leave people alone?
I don't know.
That's
I don't know.
The thing. I don't know if it's us leaving them alone that's the issue.
I just, my fear is like, yeah, I don't know. They're just, it's just, it's my, that whole encounter, my time at like the, it was just so, I never realized how many unarmed or,
Yeah, tell me more about this at the police station.
Yeah, well, so we get there, and then I fill out, like, a report. And this dude's just trying to get me to, like, pin something on this guy. Yeah.
So this, like, just to clarify, this was after someone in your neighborhood looked like they had a gun and it was just you.
I'm like, oh yeah, no.
For an obviously good reason.
I was like, I can't, like, I don't want to call the police, but if someone dude actually has a gun, yeah, I don't need this going around in my name. And it was a replica. It was like they didn't show it to me, but it was a replica handgun. Like, yeah, there's no reason to not think it was not a weapon from far away.
Yeah.
And I get there and I'm just like chilling in this room. I don't, not necessarily like an interrogation room. There was like pamphlets and whatnot on the wall. Like, I think there's a lot of like, maybe like a 14-year-old, like a troubled 14-year-old would go in there and be like, don't smoke weed, like, here. But anyway, I write a statement and this dude's like, yeah, so we're releasing him on a court date. And, I'm like, what? So he's gone. I'm still here though. Like, this is a weird thing. Like, so I'm still here, but he's gone. And I mind you, when I came home eventually, I saw him on the stoop again. Mm-hmm. Like, he's just like a dude down the street. I'm like, yo, what? Like, did you take the little toy gun at least, man? Like, you're like, here, don't do anything stupid with it. Here it is. Anyway, no, and he just tried to like get me to like pin disturbance on this guy. I'm like, well, I'm not just gonna pin this dude on a charge that like you guys just let him go for. Like, I just, screw you, man. And then he's like, yeah, I'll give you a ride home. And then I waited outside for 20 minutes while he just, I don't know what he did. He just was like, he's like, yeah, I'll meet you around front, just 2 seconds. I was like, okay, cool. So yeah, just, he's like, and it's like, sorry, my days are grueling, man. I'm like, oh, for sure. And then I tried to make a joke and he didn't like it very much. I was just like, he waved a car through to like, he's like, yeah, you can go instead of me. And then I'm like, oh, is that out of speeding tickets? And he was just like, oh, like, I'm just like, okay,
that's a good one.
I'm like, okay, you frigid bastard. Like, what is your deal? I don't know, man. At the end of the day, I just look at the dudes who I know from high school who became jocks. And they're like just knuckleheads who like don't really know what the hell is going on. Like, I don't know, whatever. I just, it's so exhausting, man. Like, I just don't know why you'd ever want to like control people like that. But that's a whole other discussion, I guess. And yeah, whatever.
So what do you think is sort of the role of journalism and the journalist in this weird modern world where sometimes it seems that just normal everyday news is problematic in some ways, in that it's what do you think about the idea that you shouldn't call a fascist a fascist, or what, you know what I mean? Like that, when there are clearly things that are something, the journalists are supposed to call it something else to avoid indicating sympathies or supposedly giving up objectivity. What if something is statistically and historically evident?
I think it kind of splits off into almost like two different thoughts in my head when you pose that question. One is, I think you should be able to say whatever you want to say in that regard. Like, if someone's being a fascist, then that's fine. You can call them a fascist. I think then on the other shoulder, so to speak, I have the idea of you probably get more bees with honey than you do with vinegar. And I think people see visceral language and they're just like, okay, give me a break, man. Because it takes a lot to read sometimes. You know, when somebody uses all the buzzwords like that, and I'm not calling it a buzzword, you know, but you know what I mean. It is like a, you know, because people use it in inappropriate circumstances, yeah, to be completely honest.
That's what I kind of think. It's my issue.
And it's also, and this might be like a hot take, but people are like, people have been using the term white supremacy like very frequently, which I think it's very frequent in our society. But if we label everything as white supremacy, then what are true white supremacists? Like, what do we call them now? And I just think that people, although I completely agree with everything behind it, I just think that people, they're losing people by increasing the rhetoric, so to speak, in all aspects of whether it be fascism or whatever.
Yeah, fascism may have been a poor example. I'm just trying to clarify too that, like, I don't really think that journalists should go around saying that's a fascist. But the idea that what I take issue with is the sort of New York Times approach to things, where the editorial board is just going to be like hands in the air. We're pretending that we don't see a lot of things that are happening, and then they set the agenda for the entire world's news.
Yeah, that's the issue, right? You bring up like a certain aspect of the conversation, and it brings up in a whole other can of worms. Like, then you get that legacy media that's kind of like another, speaking of buzzwords, like New York Times, Washington Post, these sort of establishment media forever. Yeah. That's a whole other, you know, ad sales, like that whole corporate world is then comes into it, yeah. Right? Certain precedent that is set when you are one of the largest media companies in the world, not media companies, but you know what I mean? Publications, so to speak. And the amount of investors and people behind the scenes that are like really controlling it. Because you look at smaller scale things like publications like The Intercept or The Gray Zone or whatever it might be. There's a certain accountability that you can kind of say on behalf of the writers, because there's, I don't know, 20 dudes or whatever it is, you know, there's like, it's a bunch of guys in the basement. Like, I know it's not actually what it is, but you know what I mean? You can tangibly see this is who's doing it, the XYZ. With like a big publication like that, how do you even know who is pulling what string at any given moment, man? It's so to let them, I think what we need to do is not let them set the precedent for what we can and cannot say, right. Which I think was what you're seeing too. Because I think that you should be able to call somebody a fascist for being a fascist. Or I think you should be able to call somebody a white supremacist for being a white supremacist. We just need to be selective with how we use the language to maximize its effectiveness. Because those are people in society that need to be called out. But we just need to, I don't want to say parse our words. Or we don't at all, we should never limit what we're saying. But people don't take you seriously when you start using buzzwordy things completely frequently. And as unfortunate as it might be, you need to play the game a little bit too to get people to listen. And if people aren't going to listen to you, you're not going to like actually change it.
You need to know your audience.
You need to know your audience. Absolutely. It's kind of, it's like what we back to like the program, it's like tech talk. You know, if you overuse buzzwords in tech talk, and people are just like, I get it, dude. Why?
It appeals a lot to a very select audience. Yeah. But the rest of people are just like,
And it's on either end. You read a right wing publication, like one of those Canada First things or whatever it might, yeah. or Rebel or whatever. They use their lexicon, and then you go to, I don't know, HuffPo or whatever, and they got a whole other thing. So yeah, it's interesting. There's like a real like war of language right now that is kind of greatly associated to the president and like all this crap. It's interesting just to see the dynamics of very simple language.
Language is, it's become especially important in the last several years, but that's a really an interesting phenomena. Like historically, it's always kind of been important, but it was something that became like really big. I think around third wave feminism is one of the areas that was one of the issues that kind of came up, is the way that like sexism is built right into the fucking language. And that's now coming up with racism too, because it is like little structural things like that. That's one of the ways to explain systemic racism. It's that the damn language has, you know, racism built right into it. Like it goes from the bottom to the top and back down again.
Absolutely. That's, I think, what an interesting realization that we're kind of having is that, it's the whole thing. The whole thing's broken.
Yeah. You know? And that's like I've been watching the news with my parents and stuff and having daily conversations of them asking like, what does this mean? And they've been remarkably open-minded. But I do understand the frustration of people who are like, there's all this, I always got these new words. I can't call people this anymore. And I can't say that.
Yeah.
Because there is a lot of it, but it's, as you were saying just a minute ago, or sort of alluding to, words are tools, and they should be used in a pretty precise way because they have a lot of meaning behind them and people give meaning to them and take meaning from them.
For sure.
And if you just refuse to use the right tools, like we were looking for a Phillips screwdriver earlier, a Robertson was not going to turn that cross-shaped screw.
An exact.
Got to have the right tool.
This is a Rick rip. I'm going to just.
Rick McLean is our journalism instructor.
Yeah. Well, he said his whole, you know, don't try to hammer like a little tiny picture frame nail with a sledgehammer. Like it's sort of, you need to know what tool to use when. It's not all, you can't just scatter gun, you know, a bunch of buzzwords. It's just people are going to like, it's flaring. It's uncomfortable, you know, pick and choose.
Yeah. So last kind of thing I was going to ask about is we've kind of already gotten into it. What do you think, how do you grapple with personally with staying objective when, I know we haven't been doing a lot of writing lately, but kind of dealing with say the uprisings in the United States or Canada's ongoing situation with Indigenous peoples. What do you think you need to do? What do you tell yourself to try and stay honest and objective?
I just take a break from it in many ways. You know, I just give myself like time throughout the day because I am my most visceral and because obviously I'm gonna lean to the left. Like it's just me. Like it's kind of gonna be my inclination, and I need to take my frame off it a little bit. Although it is, you know, I could give my whole opinion on it. That's not neither here nor there. But like, you know. I just need to take a break from it because I get worked up and, you know, I start sharpening a pitchfork and I'm like, we need to tear the whole thing down. And like I get real, like, you know, all you and I have messaged each just, you know, ramblings of like, we need to change it. You just need to take a break. You need to go like do something else that it doesn't involve visceral emotion. All like you do it all day. And I mean, recently it's just been being able to work in a job that is completely aside from it. Mm-hmm. And then I get to come home and watch the news or do whatever, but I can put it down at the end of the day. I mean, during quarantine, it would just be like, you go for a walk, like, or go for a drive, like that sort of thing. I come to think like, I mean, there's a variety of other tools you can use to take your mind off things. And, you know, we do that too. But I mean, I don't know. Like I like to go get a coffee. I like to do something maybe a little bit physical. Before I started work, I would do random things around. Like I live in this old apartment building. And like the landlord didn't ask me to, but I just like fix the fence or like do something that is it's like mindless work. Find a bit of mindless work to do and just do it, you know, rake the leaves. Like, you know, we're in PEI. We have such gnarly spring cleanup that you got to do kind of on your lawn. Just do that. Like just do something. Go to your parents. Like if you live in an apartment, go to your parents' place and like do something. I know it's like kind of a piss off. Like when your mom's like, hey, go like lift this mulch or whatever. But like, if you just like take yourself out of your tunnel a little bit, you can kind of like just, it refreshes your brain a bit and you can kind of see how other people live. Or that's kind of like also why I like going for a walk sometimes is like, because you get in an echo chamber of like all your friends or your associates who kind of think like you, and you're like, you just reverb off each other and you're not hearing another side of things. But like you can just go in for a walk downtown, pop it into Tim's or whatever, you see a whole slew of different life stories and you're like, oh wait, there are, regardless of my emotions, there are other people who have greatly different outlooks on everything.
I really like the going for a walk thing. Is you can't stay stuck on one thought.
Exactly.
When you're going for a walk,
looking for cars and like it's very,
and the sights and the sounds and just the everything you're going to, even if your thoughts continue to be bad, they're gonna change, so you won't get stuck in one dark place and you'll probably end up feeling better. I usually do anyway.
Yeah. And I mean, this is even, but this is like a smaller thing. You're just taking a shower or something. Like, I guess
doing the dishes.
Doing the dishes. Like, literally, like, I mean, you said like anarchy is like doing the dishes. Like, you just gotta eat it sometimes and do something. There's an absolute gratification in like, you probably have a table in your house that's like a little wobbly.
Uh-huh.
Why don't you like drive to the store and like pick up like a $2 little thing that's gonna level your table and it's gonna make your entire life better. And it's so easy.
The toilet paper holder in my parents' house was never properly attached to the wall. And so like every time you go to get some toilet paper, the fucking thing falls off.
Awful. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Weeks of that. And then I realized, oh, it's got a little screw on the bottom and it's a weird kind of thing that kind of snaps in. And whoever put it on didn't realize what they were doing. I was like, this is the last time I'm dealing with this. Mm. And then just got down on the floor on my back, like felt like a plumber, made sure I got the crack of my ass showing a little bit.
You change your pants.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
It's great. It's satisfying, man.
Yeah. My front porch, like front, it's just like a box, essentially a wooden box that you step onto to get up to the, you know, house level, essentially. It's a very small porch, so to speak. And it was just rotted and broken. And like every day I would come and it was like, you know, when a piece of wood turns more into a springboard than anything else.
Yep.
Like that was kind of what the level of it was. It was like, my foot's going through this any day. And then one day my foot went through it, like sort of, like it just cracked a little bit. And I was like, well, I'm building a new deck here today. And I built this little box and it was, you know, it's a bit of a challenge, but just like keep busy in another way too, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Find something else to do that isn't like gonna make you all pissed. Like,
and that abrupt ending will take us to this week's progress report. This is the segment where I talk with you listeners about what I've been learning as OJT's host, producer, promoter, website person, etc. But before I get into it, a note about the interview with Alex. I'm aware that the role of language has been a subject in philosophy for as long as words have been used, long before third wave feminism, and this of course includes works from people of color. The point I was ineffectively making is that the role of language seems now to be more of a mainstream issue, so anyone who caught that, don't at me. Or do, actually. I'm always looking to learn. I just get excited talking history and philosophy and sometimes don't cover all my bases, and sometimes I'm just plain wrong. Now, from corrections to reflections. Some listeners will notice I've been releasing a lot of part twos lately. I live with Crohn's disease, and while it's mostly controlled these days, problems with changing medications have had me in a mild flare-up. Nothing too serious, just troubling enough to prevent recording new interviews. I'm telling you this so you know why I'm releasing certain episodes, but also because I think representation of invisible disabilities is important. So yeah, shout out to all my IBD crew. Anyway, as noted in an earlier progress report, I still have some back catalog as I try to record about two or more episodes of material with each guest. On the upside, the spiciest content is often later in the recordings. The big downside, though, is the continued lack of diversity on this podcast. I'm aware of the majority white guyishness of my episodes so far, and the analytics reflect this in my audience. Anyway, I'm trying to avoid making excuses. I need to work harder on outreach, as I don't know that many people in Charlottetown. I did a poor job in my first year at Holland College of getting to know the people around me and outside of my program, which includes an impressive number of international students who damn sure have passions and projects. PEI is a more diverse place than when I was a kid here, and this show ought to reflect the people it hopes to reach. OJT isn't just for Islanders by any means, but every platform needs a foundation, and where better to build it than my own backyard. And that's all for episode 9. You can follow Alex McIsaac on Instagram at Alex McIsaac and on Twitter at AA McIsaac. That's McIsaac with an M-A-C, not M-C. You can follow this podcast on Instagram at OJT_podcast and on Twitter at OJT Podcast. The Facebook page is OJT on the job training. You can follow me on Instagram at Logan.McLean.75 and on Twitter at LoganMcLean94. And finally, listeners, please check out my website, ojtpod.ca, for more pictures and some written stories from Alex, along with my own written stories in photography and pages on other past guests and episodes. The podcast is available there and on all major streaming platforms. Please rate and subscribe and leave a review. Everything helps when getting a podcast off the ground. And if you like this show and want more interesting guests, listener feedback is the best way to help me reach new people and make that happen. This has been OJT on the job training. I'm Logan McLean. Thank you for listening.